Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Graphic Storytellers with Matthew J. Smith in this month's Sochi Talks. And Emily McCord has this week's Politics Ohio, that and more. Up first, Juliet Fromholt has another selection from the Antioch Writers Workshop.
Hi, I'm Juliet Fromholt with this week's reading from the Antioch Writers Workshop. This week we'll hear from Jerry Dennis, a freelance writer celebrated for his work about nature and the great outdoors. He's written 11 books and numerous articles for National Geographic, Audubon, and Smithsonian, among others. Here he'll recount the story of a memorable winter in Michigan's Upper Peninsula.
There was a winter in 1977 and 78. When 32 feet of snow fell on the Upper Peninsula, and I'm calculating the ceiling's 25 feet. That was total snowfall. It was never that much on the ground at one time. It settled, and maybe there was a little meltage, but it was a lot of snow. And that was the winter that my wife and I moved to the Upper Peninsula. We drove up to Marquette to go to school, and that was the welcome we received. So this is a little essay about that first winter. We drove into Marquette for the first time on a bright January day in 1977 when fog had slipped in from Lake Superior and left everything it touched covered with a furry coat of rime. Snowbanks stood so high along the streets that pedestrians walking on them could have reached up and touched the telephone wires. Although Marquette is the largest city in the Upper Peninsula, it is a small and compact town built on hills that drop abruptly to the shore of Superior. In a typical winter, it receives 18 or 20 feet of snow. When the wind is up and from the north, it charges from Ontario across 150 miles of open lake, throwing plumes of spray hundreds of feet inland and laminating every surface with ice. It is a place shaped and colored by weather. Our second winter there, we rented an apartment a few blocks from downtown in an aging house we shared with three young men, a student and two lapsed students, who quickly became friends and began sharing our meals, music, books, and enthusiasm for the outdoors. The boys, capitalized, as Gail called them, were veterans of several Marquette winters. They took us cross-country skiing in the Yellow Dog Plains and snowshoeing to frozen Laughing Whitefish Falls and drove us to a local ski resort after it had closed for the night, where we hurtled down the slopes on dinner trays we had stolen from the university cafeteria. "Wait until it storms," they said. "You've never seen a blizzard until you've seen a Lake Superior blizzard." We woke one January morning that second year to find the temperature outside had fallen to 35 degrees below zero. A few miles inland, it was 50 below. When I stepped outside, I saw people up and down the street trying without success to start their cars, their hoods in the air like arms thrown up in surrender. Our 10-year-old van started without difficulty, and I passed a neighborly hour giving jump starts. In the few minutes it took to step outside and attach the jumper cables to a battery, my ears, fingers, and toes would go numb, and my nostrils would swell with what felt like cotton bowls the size of walnuts. Most of the neighbors were students from southern Michigan who had never experienced such cold. We exchanged wondering comments, watching as the breath that hung around our heads crystallized and fell to the ground as fine snow. The storm came a few weeks later. Clouds moved in that morning, and the temperature climbed to the upper 20s, warmer than it had been in a month. The streets were coated with ice formed by snow that had been packed by traffic and frozen until it was as hard as concrete. All day, the light was soft and strange. On television, the weatherman grinned and said, "Get ready, folks. It looks like we're in for a blinger." It was reason, of course, for a party. We telephoned friends and told them to bring food and sleeping bags, then laced on our ice skates and sashayed down the middle of the street to the Red Owl supermarket, where we were met at the door by a weary manager who put up his hands and said, "Hey, hey, this ain't Skate World." Inside, we slid around the aisles in our stocking feet, loading a grocery cart with beer, chips, and frozen dinners, greeting everyone we met. Young people were animated and talkative, their eyes bright. Old folks acted the way they always acted. We had noticed already that the people who boasted loudest about the difficulties of winters in the Upper Peninsula were usually recent immigrants, many of them from Detroit, a 450-mile drive south of Marquette, where winters are cold and damp but often free of measurable snowfall. Natives of the UP, many of them descended from Finns, Swedes, and Italians who moved to the region in the 19th century to work in the mines, were apparently too acclimated to the weather to give it much thought. To them, winter was not a romantic adventure or a Courier Knives abstraction, but a fact of life, like unemployment, taxes, and backaches. Their stoicism could be extreme. Our second autumn in Marquette, I worked for 6 months repairing railroad tracks on the Chicago Northwestern line near Ishpeming, a town 15 miles inland from Marquette. Our crew of three included two native Upers, career railroaders who dreamed of being promoted to brakemen so they could spend their days riding in a heated caboose. I was taking a semester off from college to work and was grateful for the job, but I have never been so uncomfortable. It was a frigid, snowy November, and the wind was relentless. In the cold, the steel tracks cracked under the pressure of cars loaded with iron ore pellets. Our job was to remove the broken sections and replace them with lengths of new rail. We did this by hand, unbolting existing track with four-foot-long wrenches, cutting broken sections away with a gasoline-powered hacksaw, driving new spikes with sledgehammers. On a day when the wind was particularly brutal and a harsh sleet lashed our faces, I groaned and muttered something like, "Man, this is miserable." I sensed immediate disapproval from the others. Nothing was said, but it was clear that I had violated a code. But for the boys and Gail and me, no such codes applied, and we allowed ourselves to be awed by the weather. Outside the supermarket, it had begun snowing, hard pellets that sheared at angles when the wind gusted, then dropped straight down and bounced along the street like excited molecules. By the time we got home, the wind blew with so much force that our house swayed, causing the water in the toilet bowl to rise and fall. The plastic sheeting our landlord had nailed over the windows bucked and snapped. We turned up the music, made dinner, drank beer, laughed, and danced. Friends arrived, loaded with groceries and talking in disbelief about the rising storm. Everyone took turns going to the door to watch the city become erased by whiteness. Gusts lifted snow into marauding clouds that swirled down the street and eddied into the openings between the houses, building drifts that by morning would reach to the eaves. Then stronger winds funneled in from the lake, carrying snow and streamers so blinding we couldn't see the houses across the street. One friend came late, red-faced and huffing, stomping his feet on the floor to get circulation back in his toes. He had abandoned his car and adrift blocks away. "No way," he said, "is anybody going anywhere tonight." We made up the couches into beds and spread sleeping bags on the floor. The moment we switched off the lights, the wind came up louder than ever. It seemed to bellow with triumph. In the morning, the windows were covered with elaborate, finely patterned frost shaped like ferns. We scraped it with our fingernails, and it fell in curls to the carpet. Breathing on the glass opened face-sized holes that allowed us to look outside. The wind continued to blow, whipping storms of loose snow down the street. All the trees were bent with their backs to the wind and looked naked and shocked. Even the telephone poles appeared to be bent over in misery. Our neighbors' houses seemed deserted, their driveways filled with drifts that covered cars to their roofs. Someone turned on the radio, and an announcer said in a cheerful voice that classes at the university were canceled and that the state police had blocked all highways out of the city. It was perfect. It was why we had come to Marquette, to be tested by extremes of nature, to watch the world throw tantrums. Staying warm in the midst of all that cold and wind made us feel capable and self-reliant and mildly heroic. We turned up the music and danced around the living room, cheering for ourselves. We were brewing coffee and scrambling eggs when someone walked onto our porch and knocked. We opened the inner door, then pushed hard on the storm door to break through the drift that had built in front of it. A swirl of snow and cold came inside. Standing before us were two middle-aged women in bulky, snow-plastered coats, headscarves knotted tightly beneath their chins. They looked like Russian peasants dressed to go to the market. Behind them, clouds of snow roared down the street. The ladies smiled shyly. In the lilting Finnish accent of a native, one of them said, "We're collecting for the United Way." My friends and I were flabbergasted. "Did you walk here?" we asked. "Yeah, down the street. It's our day for collecting." It was unthinkable to turn them away. We invited them inside and filled their donation envelopes with pocket change. We offered them coffee and breakfast, but they couldn't stay. They had many houses to visit, they said, and because of the condition of the streets, they would have to do all their visiting on foot. And they wanted to be finished in time to have supper ready when their husbands came home from work. Thank you.
The Soshi Talks program is designed to enlighten the world with knowledge from primarily institutions of higher education in Southwest Ohio. Here's our selection for today.
I am Matthew J. Smith from Wittenberg University. It's been said that Ohio is the heart of it all, and while that particular campaign slogan was useful for bringing tourists into the state of Ohio, there's also a ring of truth to it when it comes to describing a field of study that I'm interested in. There seem to be an atypical number of influential figures who have their roots planted firmly in Ohio soil and stretch out into the development of the field of graphic storytelling. Graphic storytelling is the kind of communication where you combine words and pictures to create distinct meanings. We think of it taking place in newspaper comic strips, comic book magazines, and graphic novels. As an art form, graphic storytelling has struggled for recognition within the wider culture. It's often been ostracized and labeled an outlier in the pantheon of the arts. Those of us who are involved in an interdisciplinary effort called comic arts studies are really trying to raise awareness of the field, the contributors who have made it great, and those who have struggled to try and break through those particular boundaries. What I'd like to talk to you about today is a handful of individuals, all who have had a life in the state of Ohio, who have been particularly influential in shaping what we know as modern graphic storytelling or comics. The five individuals I'd like to talk about today are Richard Outcault, a famous newspaper cartoonist, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, the creators of Superman, Harvey Pekar, an outspoken independent cartoonist, and Jeff Smith, the creator of the popular all-ages series Bone. Richard Outcault's success really became a model for other cartoonists to aspire to. Outcault was born in Lancaster, Ohio, and he was a prodigy in terms of his artistic talent, finding himself on his way to the University of Cincinnati School of Design as a young man. After working as an illustrator for Thomas Edison, Outcault became a contributor to the New York World, one of the influential newspapers in New York City of its day, published by Joseph Pulitzer. Outcault debuted Hogan's Alley in May of 1895, and one of the characters that was featured in that particular cartoon was a young man in a yellow nightshirt running around his neighborhood. That young man became known as the Yellow Kid and a famous character from that day forth. Now, Outcault wasn't necessarily a true innovator in the sense that he used multiple panels to tell stories or thought of speech balloons for the first time or even used color initially. But he is worth noting because he was the first to really popularize the use of these items in tandem. In fact, it was interest in the Yellow Kid that helped sell most newspapers at the time. So popular was Outcault's cartoon that Pulitzer's chief competitor, William Randolph Hearst, came knocking on his door and enticed him to come over and work for him at a competing newspaper. Both publishers became synonymous with Outcault's Yellow Kid, and the sensationalism that they practiced in the other pages of their newspaper became the basis for the label of yellow journalism, a stigma that stays with those who practice unsavory journalism to this day. The stigma, though, didn't stick with Outcault himself. In 1902, he went on to have even more success with another cartoon character called Buster Brown. Buster Brown is what we might call today one of the earliest transmedia properties of the time. He was the star of not just cartoons, but went on to be popular in stage plays and even silent films. You might know Buster Brown from the popular shoe line that still bears the character's name. Outcault inspired a generation of boys to want to grow up and become successful cartoonists themselves. The lucrative world of syndicated comics was a particular draw for two young men from Cleveland, Ohio, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Both of them, working in tandem, created one of the most memorable characters in American fiction, Superman. Siegel was born in 1914 in Cleveland, Ohio. Shuster had been born in Toronto and moved to the United States as a child. By 1931, the two were in Cleveland's Glenville High School together, becoming first friends and then collaborators on a number of artistic projects. Siegel would write the scripts, and Schuster would illustrate them. Initially, they found some work post-graduation for DC Comics, selling strips like Dr. Occult and Slam Bradley, but were notorious for not being able to sell their prized concept, Superman. Finally, in 1938, their publisher at DC Comics agreed to give Superman a spot in the newly launched Action Comics. Superman proved to be a phenomenon. It is not an understatement to say that Superman created the comic magazine industry. His lead inspired others to join the medium and led to a proliferation of comics across the United States. Superman as a character, of course, has gone on to star in virtually every other medium that we have available to us, and he's become an iconic representation of the United States. Siegel and Schuster were initially beneficiaries of that popularity, but in the long term, they had signed over rights to DC Comics for the character. They would spend years trying to reclaim some of that fortune that came along with the fame of the character. And theirs became a cause célèbre for many in the industry who recognized that doing work for hire for major publishers meant taking a risk that you would lose your own creative license over the characters. Later creators did find their voice, though, outside the dynamics of the major publishers. One in particular was a gentleman from Cleveland named Harvey Pekar. Pekar is best known as the creator of the self-published comic book series American Splendor. He was born in Cleveland in 1939 and graduated from Shaker Heights High School. He attended Case Western Reserve University, and after a stint in the Navy, he returned to Cleveland to work for Cleveland's Veterans Administration Hospital. Not exactly the pedigree you'd expect for a famous cartoonist. But in 1976, Pekar decided to move beyond the humdrum experiences working at a VA and began to chronicle his livelihood in the pages of American Splendor. This wasn't more superheroics or cartoon illustrations of rough and tumble children. This was about everyday life. His friend and collaborator, Robert Crumb, who had already gained some acclaim as an underground comics artist himself, encouraged Pekar to tell stories about himself, a trip to the grocery store, the thrill of writing a jazz column for a magazine. These became the basis of a long-time effort on Picard's part that stretched until 2010 and his death, and in fact, has even gone beyond as some posthumous works continue to come forward. Pekar was one of the most influential voices in what we've come to know as memoir comics. These are autobiographical accounts of how someone's life is lived. They are currently much the rage in the comics industry, and they represent a more mature step forward for what you can do with comics. By the 1980s, Pekar had become well-known to audiences in television land as a frequent guest star on Late Night with David Letterman. In 2003, his exploits were adapted into the film, aptly titled American Splendor, and the film featured Paul Giamatti playing Harvey Pekar. It was named Grand Jury Prize winner for dramatic film at Sundance and was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay. Pekar, however, isn't the only independent publisher from the state of Ohio who has impacted the comics industry. Jeff Smith is best known for the creation of Bone, an all-ages saga that seeks to explore the wonder of discovery and revelation. Smith had been born in McKees Rock, Pennsylvania in 1960, but moved to Columbus as a child. He grew up in the Worthington neighborhood and graduated from Worthington High School before going on to The Ohio State University. There, he worked on the college newspaper, The Lantern, and developed a strip called Thorn. Many of the characters in Thorn went on to appear in Bone, a long saga that he began in 1991 when he launched his company, Cartoon Books. The idea of Bone was to explore the possibility of publishing an independent voice in a medium largely embraced or controlled by large companies. Cartoon Books, under Jeff Smith, published 55 black and white issues of Bone between 1991 and 2004. To most people, comics are ephemera. They are here today and gone tomorrow. The comics that are on the shelves right now, sold out and forgotten in short order. One of the things that Jeff Smith did to really turn the industry on its ear was begin to put his comics back into print after a period of time, so that new audiences discovering his adventures later on could go back and pick up the saga from the beginning. He also turned the industry on its head when he compiled the entire 55-volume saga in one large publication in 2004 called The Brick. It's a 1,300-page compilation of the entire Bones saga. Time magazine has hailed it as the best all-ages graphic novel yet published. And in point in fact, Scholastic, the world's largest children's publisher, created a new imprint in 2005 and featured Bone in full color as the first title to be released through that imprint. Smith's art has now been featured in museum shows at the Wexner Center, and in 2009, a documentary chronicled his life and exercises called The Cartoonist. In conclusion, these five individuals would likely make any list of comics greats, but that they have all had lives in the state of Ohio says something extraordinary about the Buckeye State. Now, part of this extraordinary set of conditions is acknowledged by our state's institutions of higher learning. Bowling Green State University houses the Brown Popular Culture Library, which has one of the most comprehensive comics collections in the country. And the Ohio State University has the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum, one of the most well-regarded collections of comics and cartoons in the world. Now, the discerning viewer may ask, why Ohio? Well, one possible explanation could be that, as heart of America, Ohio does have a sense of cohesion with the rest of the nation, that an all-American upbringing in the heart of the nation brings with it an understanding of how to reach across the nation and appeal to a mass audience. Another possible explanation is that, like that other hotbed of creative activity, New York City, a lot of working-class people were striving to make a better life for themselves in Ohio. They found comics as a medium that would give them the means to rise above their station and achieve both a contribution to the arts and a modicum of fame for themselves. Comics are a unique art form in the sense that they provide access that is widespread. All you really need is some paper, a pencil, and an active imagination. Harvey Pekar once said, "Comics are just words and pictures. You can do anything in the world with words and pictures." These individuals prove that, indeed, you certainly can. Thank you.
That was Matthew J. Smith in this month's Soche Talks. Find out more at soche.org.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. State legislators are kicking off the lame duck session with a bill that would affect family planning in Ohio. It would reprioritize funding for family planning so that it would effectively put Planned Parenthood last on the list to receive that funding. To talk to me about what this means, I'm joined by Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, who's been reporting on the matter. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So when we're saying it would be a shift in money making Planned Parenthood last, how will that affect what that organization does? Is it a question of timing or allocation of funding?
Well, kind of both. It's over $1 million of Planned Parenthood money comes through this pass-through. It's federal and state funds. And the way that it's operated in the past, Planned Parenthood has got a lot of that money. But now they want to change, the state lawmakers with this bill want to change the guidelines for how that money's passed through. And they want to include community clinics, community health clinics. They want to include private practices. If this happens and the bill goes through and it's signed into law, Planned Parenthood tells me that they could lose over $1 million a year, and that could really have a devastating impact on their budget. They say that, you know, Planned Parenthood is a brand that people who find themselves in need of family planning services would know, you know, to contact Planned Parenthood, where some of these clinics or private practices, that sort of thing, they don't necessarily know to go there.
Couldn't it just be that this actually gives women more choices on where to get their care?
It does. It gives women more choices. And as the people who are pushing this plan, the Republicans mainly who are pushing this plan, point out that in some small rural areas of the state, Planned Parenthood doesn't operate there. So this would, they say, open up money to the organizations that do operate there, that serve those women in rural areas. The question needs to be raised as to why why aren't they applying for this money anyway? It basically is not set aside for just Planned Parenthood. It's set aside for family planning clinics. Now, what Planned Parenthood would point out is that, you know, in some urban areas, and especially in areas around college campuses where women may not know what's available, they do know Planned Parenthood because it has a long history and they know what it does and what it provides.
So where does the question of abortion fit into all this? Do these other clinics and other providers give the same access to health care needs to women that Planned Parenthood does?
Well, and that's the key. Emily, you know, they don't mention the backers of this bill do not really mention that abortion is the reason behind it. But some of the people who have gotten up to testify on behalf of the bill say, hey, they don't like the fact that Planned Parenthood provides abortions and the fact that that group provides abortions, and they don't like abortions. They don't want their money going to it for any reason, whether that's, you know, for an abortion, which it cannot legally go, you know, public money cannot go for an abortion. And Planned Parenthood says it keeps that separate, so it does not go for abortion. But they don't even like the idea of it going for birth control services because they say that that helps keep the lights on, that helps, you know, in other ways with this organization that they say provides abortion, and they're just not happy with that.
Why is this happening now?
Well, it's the lame duck session, and they have to finish up all of the lawmakers in the state have to finish up all of the legislation that's currently on the table. Otherwise, it dies at the end of the year. This legislation, it's been passed now through this House committee, and it will go to the House. But then the Senate would have to take it up and pass it, and it would have to be signed into law by the end of this year for it to go into effect. Otherwise, it wouldn't go into effect. They'd have to start all over again next year when the new lawmakers come in. So that's kind of why they're picking it up now, because if they don't pick it up now, they can't pick it up. They have to start all over again.
Tell me about the political ramifications behind this measure.
Last week, well, on Election Day, Ohio voters spoke pretty loudly. We thought it was going to be a much closer race, but really, President Obama had a good win in Ohio. And if you look at the exit polling, one of the things that came out, we know that women were more likely to vote for President Obama than they were for Mitt Romney. And we also know that this issue of family planning, abortion, women's rights, this was an issue that was a key issue in that campaign. So, you know, Planned Parenthood right now is saying, why in the world would lawmakers, after seeing, you know, what happened at the polls, why would they take this up? Why would they go against this? Now, lawmakers, you know, it depends who you talk to, but they don't necessarily see those exit polls the same way. And they say, well, you know, this is an important issue. It's a matter of priority and matter of philosophy, and they need to do it right now. So, you know, we've got this issue, though, coming up at a time when it's fresh in the minds of voters. And for women, especially the women who went to the polls and voted for Barack Obama, this is a reminder for them as to why they voted the way they did.
I've been speaking with Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks for being here, Joe.
Well, thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of Why So Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.
WISO is working on a multimedia documentary project called Reinvention Stories. We're asking the question, how does a city of inventors reinvent itself? And we want to hear from you. How do you think Dayton is doing? How can we reinvent ourselves and our city? Are we on the right track? Call our listener line and share your thoughts. The number is 769-1374.
Later today on This American Life, a music professor believes that he's found a way to kill microorganisms with sound waves, and he starts to wonder if they could destroy cancer cells.
No chemo, no radiation, no cutting. You walk in and they have a large bulb and they turn it on for 3 minutes, and inside of a month you're done.
He teams up with a real cancer researcher, a serious one, and gets unexpected results.
This afternoon at 4 on WISO.